Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 6th of November, these are our main stories. A top US diplomat has directly contradicted President Trump's claim that there was no link between military aid to Ukraine and an investigation by Kiev into his rival Joe Biden. Thousands of scientists from around the world have joined forces to declare a global climate emergency. And the Zimbabwean government has sacked nearly 80 doctors who went on strike over pay. Also in this podcast,
Hamilton man Steve Morrow had a simple wish. He wanted to buy one singular, solitary chicken for his backyard.
But sometimes online shopping can go horribly wrong, as we will discover later. The impeachment inquiry into President Trump has released comments from a senior American diplomat who's admitted telling a Ukrainian official that US military aid hinged on a political inquiry into the president's rival Joe Biden. In a written testimony, the US ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, said he made the comments in September in a conversation with an aide to the Ukrainian president. President Trump has denied withholding aid to Ukraine over the issue. Jamie Raskin, a Democrat congressman, said the testimonies from the inquiry were all pointing to one thing.
The critical thing I think America needs to focus on is people read the depositions is that there's really only one story. All of the witnesses agree that the president engineered a shakedown of the Ukrainian government. Nothing like that has ever happened in American history before, and nobody has any kind of alternative story.
Our correspondent in Washington, Anthony Zerker, has been following developments.
We got the details of Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the EU's deposition from last month, which was interesting. But what was most interesting was that he went back and released an additional three-page addendum that was tagged on to his deposition that revised some of that testimony. And what he revised, what he was talking about, was he said that in a September 1st meeting with Ukrainian officials in Poland, he said that it was very likely that U.S. military aid to Ukraine was being conditioned on them opening up investigations into corruption. And by what that meant was investigations into this energy company Burisma that had ties to Joe Biden's son, and also into the 2016 election hacking and a conspiracy theory that Ukraine was behind it. So here you have someone who is directly involved in essentially laying out this quid pro quo with Ukraine, which is what many of Donald Trump's critics have alleged all along was happening.
And we've heard many denials that there was any quid pro quo. What difference does this testimony make? Will it make a difference?
Well, it very well could. I mean, he's not the first person. Sondland is not the first person to talk about this. But those were kind of long-term foreign policy hands. This is a political appointee, someone who was a Donald Trump donor for his inauguration, who had been appointed to the ambassadorship by Donald Trump, who had been chosen by Donald Trump to be kind of an unofficial point person on dealing with Ukraine and dealing with his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, on Ukrainian matters. And here he's coming out saying that this was quid pro quo, essentially. Now, what the White House says to counter that is, well, this was just Sondland's presumptions that he didn't know why military aid was being held up. He didn't know who did it or when. He was essentially putting his own spin on this, and he was misinterpreting it, that Donald Trump did not want a quid pro quo, and that he was very explicit in talking to Sondland that this was not the case. That's still going to, Donald Trump's defenders, the White House, are still going to say there was no quid pro quo. You're going to see some Republicans say, well, even if there was, that was perfectly within the powers of the presidency. But I think Sondland did give a very powerful piece of information that Donald Trump's critics and Democrats can use in their case that this constitutes impeachable offenses.
That was Anthony Zerker in Washington. Thousands of scientists across the globe have backed research that declares a climate emergency. They say that without deep and lasting changes, the world is facing untold human suffering and governments are failing to address the crisis. Matt McGrath is our environment correspondent, and he told us about the study's scope and findings.
I think what's really different about this report is that instead of just looking at one thing like global surface temperatures or something like that, they've decided to broaden the range of their data. And they've looked at a range of things like how many passengers are going on planes, how much meat we're eating, how many trees we're losing. When you add all those up together over the last 40 years, they say clearly and unequivocally, we're now in an emergency situation, a climate emergency, they're calling it. And that's the reason why they've gone with this particular definition. They say when you look across the piece, you can't come to any other conclusion.
And when we say climate emergency, what exactly does that mean?
That's a very good question. What they mean by that really is that the range of things that we're expecting to happen may be much worse than we're expecting to happen. So we may get to a certain situation where we reach tipping points where things happen very rapidly. If we lose all the ice in the Arctic, for instance, what does that mean over the next 10 or 20 years? How will that impact the world? And so they say these are unknowns. They say that it could end up with parts of the Earth that could become uninhabitable. And that's how serious it is. That's how deeply they believe that this is the direction we're heading. And that's what they mean by an emergency.
And we've been talking about a climate emergency for quite some time. Have there been no improvements?
There have been lots of improvements. There's lots of things happening. Even though when we look at what's happening in the news today with President Trump pulling out of the Paris Agreement, the backdrop is the world waking up to this problem and doing something about it. The question is it going fast enough? Because we've had massive amounts of renewable energy, say, gone up by 300% in 10 years. That's great. That's fantastic. If you look at 2018, the amount of fossil fuels and gas being used compared to renewables is 28 times greater. So we're still doing the wrong things in climate terms. We're getting there. We're making progress. The Paris Agreement is part of that. But it's, the scientists would say, when you add all that up, it doesn't go quickly enough, fast enough in the right direction.
Do the authors of this report have any recommendations of what they want us to do?
They certainly do. They have lots of recommendations. They broadly categorise in a number of different areas, but they range from relatively simple things, such as planting more trees, planting more mangroves, things that will absorb carbon quickly. Cutting short-term pollutants in the atmosphere, like methane gas and soot. These are things that can make a big difference over the next couple of decades. Changing our diets, for instance, is a big thing. Eating less meat and eating more plant-based materials. And also the biggies, such as changing the way we do energy and stopping subsidies to companies on the basis of fossil fuels. So these are all things we've heard before. They're reiterated by the scientists and they think that they need to be put out there more clearly so people, governments and everybody gets the picture.
Our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath. The government of Zimbabwe has dismissed 77 doctors who've been taking part in a two-month strike over pay. Last month, a court ruled that the strike was illegal and ordered them back to work. Zimbabwe is in the midst of an economic crisis and high inflation has severely eroded people's earnings. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
It looks like Zimbabwe's government's determined to keep playing hardball. 77 doctors have now been fired and hundreds of their colleagues who are also on strike are waiting to hear their fate. It seems unthinkable that they can all be fired because the impact on the already struggling health service would be disastrous. Due to the rampant inflation, the real value of a doctor's salary has plummeted to the equivalent of less than $100 a month. With members of the civil service due to take to the streets on Wednesday, the pressure's building on President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Every day, this economic crisis is making life harder and harder for Zimbabweans.
Will Ross. President Trump, in a telephone call with his Mexican counterpart Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has offered US assistance to help Mexico bring to justice the people who killed 9 members of an American Mormon family in an ambush in the north of the country. Earlier, the Mexican president said the Le Baron family's vehicle convoy might have been mistaken by the attackers for a rival gang. The family were members of a breakaway Mormon community that settled in northern Mexico decades ago. Tim Franks spoke to Falco Ernst, Mexico analyst with the International Crisis Group based in Mexico City, and heard more about the Le Baron family.
So, I mean, it is a Mormon colony, as it were, which has been in that part of northern Mexico for decades now, at least. They have lived or sought a closed-off lifestyle in their own communities while seeking respectful relationships with the surrounding society, Mexican society. They had, over the past years, try to negotiate their permanence there with the de facto powers, including corrupt politicians and criminal forces, and had largely succeeded in sustaining their special place, their special role in that part of Mexico. And that negotiated model had already shown cracks over the last years. 10 years ago, for instance, two of their members were assassinated following pressure by criminal forces, and yesterday it came crushing down massively.
Is the best guess that this was just a case of mistaken identity, or could there have been a more sinister motive behind this?
So it's a bit too early to call still. We know that the Mexican government came out today suggesting that it was a mistaken shooting, that they were aiming at somebody else, and that the family was caught in a crossfire. But there's other voices out there, people who had been in touch with the family over the past years, saying that a criminal pressure had been imminent toward them over the past years, and that this act could also be have followed their continued refusal to give in to criminal pressures, to pay protection payments, and other forms of predatory criminal behavior, which has become very common throughout Mexico, including Chihuahua and Sonora, the two states in question here.
Falco Ernst, a Mexico analyst with the International Crisis Group. Authorities in the ancient Japanese city of Kyoto have banned photography in parts of the city's main geisha neighbourhood. This follows complaints about harassment and bad behaviour by foreign tourists in the quest for the perfect selfie. JJ O'Donoghue is a journalist in Kyoto.
The selfie ban, as it's becoming to be known, is a symptom of the bigger problem, which is over-tourism in certain parts of Japan, especially here in Kyoto. And they have, on some private streets, put up signs telling tourists basically that they're not allowed to take photographs, especially of geckos or geishas, as they're known here. This part of Gion in Kyoto, it's very beautiful and it's still intact. And you can understand why millions of tourists are coming to Kyoto. There's dozens of World Heritage sites here and so many brilliant restaurants. Last year alone, there was nearly 55 million tourists. That includes Japanese and foreign visitors. And it's a city of 1.5 million people. So it's much more condensed than somewhere like Tokyo or Osaka, which are also like meccas for tourists.
Outline for us what tends to happen in those concentrated areas when people want to take photographs, because it's obviously really upset the authorities.
Yeah. And they're standing around like tourists do anywhere else. There are people watching. And then there is working geishas moving from house to house or from restaurant to restaurant. And naturally, for many people, it's the first time they'll have seen a geisha. So, of course, they want to take a photo. And they might kind of run after the geisha and maybe touch the kimono they're wearing. But like they'll just swarm around. It can be very disconcerting for the women, because A, they're just trying to do their work, get from business to business. And also, it's not something that's not done here at all.
So it's a way of managing the huge numbers, obviously, but it's also a cultural issue. I mean, I wonder, it does feel as though, given the active encouragement to try and get tourists to come because of the economy, it does feel slightly odd to then make punitive measures to stop people enjoying themselves.
It does sound a bit kind of patronising to be, say, on the one hand, please come and visit. And Japan is very famous for this concept of omotenashi, where you provide for your visitors or your guests. But then also to be kind of very, like there's signs up everywhere reminding people to be quiet and to not loiter and not take selfies. And that can be patronising, especially when Japan's government, they are pushing tourism numbers. The goal for the 2020 Olympics next year is to have 40 million tourists visit. As far as what they can do, what restrictions they're going to come up with, this is something they still haven't at all decided on. And this selfie ban is kind of the first step.
So what do you think? Will it work?
I mean, they're not legally binding. The fine is 10,000 yen, about £70. But I don't imagine anyone will actually get fined. It's more about to create awareness that you're in an area that's used by residents, then please be respectful and please be mindful.
JJ O'Donoghue talking to Razia Iqbal. Still to come in this podcast.
I'm sitting in the living room and he comes up to my face. I could tell he was thinking or, you know, processing something. And then he just looks at me and he goes, would someone like me?
The moment a 21-year-old autistic son asked his mother his first ever question. To Yemen now, a country that's been ravaged by 4 years of war, during which more than 100,000 people are believed to have been killed. Now Yemen's internationally recognised government has struck a deal with separatists in the south of the country that's intended to end a power struggle there. The conflict has become very complicated, so I began by asking our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston just who these separatists are.
In Yemen's civil war, you have on the one side the Houthi rebel movement in the north. On the other, there's the Yemeni government and various allies. One of the government's allies has been a powerful separatist movement that actually wants independence for South Yemen. South Yemen used to be an independent state, but it was merged in 1990 with the north to make one nation. Many southerners have been unhappy with that arrangement. They want to secede. There's been tension with the government. And in August, there was an explosion of violence. The southern separatists clashed heavily with the government's forces and actually drove them out of the port of Aden, the most important city in the south.
Explain to us the involvement of the Saudis.
The Saudis have been deeply involved in the Yemeni civil war. They've sided with the government against those northern Houthi rebels. And of course, the Saudis looked on appalled as the government fell out very violently with the southern separatists. Suddenly, a rift had opened up on that side of the war that the Saudis were backing. And the Saudis were keen to smooth over those differences. What made it worse for the Saudis was that the UAE, the most important regional ally of Riyadh, had actually supported the southern separatists. So the Saudis, as I say, keen to sort out those divisions, and they managed to broker this deal that was signed in Riyadh.
And just tell us a little bit about the deal.
The deal will be a power-sharing arrangement. There'll be a new government cabinet formed, which will draw in a number of southern separatists. They'll get a number of ministries, and there'll be a merging, too, of the forces of the separatists and the government.
That was Alan Johnston. The President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, has cast doubt on assertions by the British Prime Minister that once the UK leaves the EU, it will be able to negotiate a comprehensive trade deal by the end of next year. He made the remarks in an interview with our Europe editor, Katia Adler, before he stands down. She sent this report.
Famous for extravagant pronouncements and gestures like kissing EU leaders on the forehead or playfully slapping their face, Jean-Claude Juncker was untypically guarded today. He didn't want to interfere in the general election, he said. But he did tell me that he thought Brexit would happen by the end of January, as Boris Johnson promises. The Brexit process has gone on too long already, Mr. Juncker said. He took issue, though, with the Prime Minister's assertion that a brand new, all-comprehensive EU-UK trade deal could then be negotiated in a year or less.
It takes time to negotiate a free trade agreement. Sometimes I have the impression that in Britain, parliamentary representatives, governmental representatives, do think that this is an easy thing to be done. It's not easy, because we are negotiating for years. With Canada, it will take time.
Mr. Juncker rejected claims that the EU was also at fault for protracted negotiations because of putting the Irish border issue at the heart of divorce talks. President Juncker said the EU was defending the interests of member state Ireland, and he appeared to contradict Boris Johnson's claim that he made the EU blink and agree to bin the backstop. Instead, Jean-Claude Juncker said a new way had been found in renegotiations to come up with the same result. During his 5 years in office, Jean-Claude Juncker has seen an EU crisis or two. The rise of populist Eurosceptic politicians, the migration crisis, the Greek debt crisis. But Brexit will arguably leave the deepest scar on the European Union. I asked President Juncker if he was tempted to stay and see the Brexit process through till the end. No, he said firmly. He'd already had too much Brexit in his life.
The outgoing president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, talking to our Europe editor, Katia Adler. Now, the next story centres around a tweet that has been shared a lot online. It was posted by a mother in the US, Kerry Block. It reads, "My 21-year-old autistic son has no communication skills. Today, he asked me his first question ever. It was, would someone like me?" Our correspondent Divya Arya spoke to Kerry, who explained how the very same day her son David had also said his first spontaneous sentence about the Jacksonville Jaguars, his favourite American football team.
He was watching a replay of the Jaguars, and thank goodness I had my phone with me. I heard him say, "I love Jaguars." So I videoed it and I put it on my Twitter page, and I only had like 200 followers at the time. And it's mostly just autistic parents. I got a few likes and a few messages, and I thought, that's great. Well, then 2 weeks later, I'm sitting in the living room, and he comes up to my face, gets in my face, and I could tell he was thinking or, you know, processing something. And then he just looks at me, and he goes, "Would someone like me?" And, I mean, I was flabbergasted. I had never, that's the first question he has ever said to me or said to us. And I was amazed. I left the room because I had to cry. I didn't want David to think I was upset, but I explained to him, you know, every day mommy and daddy say we love you, you know, we constantly. I said, but I don't think we've ever said I like you. And I said, and of course, you know, mommy and daddy like you. I'm sure there are thousands of people out there that would like you. And I know they would. You know, you're a wonderful boy. But I went to Twitter and I, you know, posted it with a little picture of David, and I sent it and didn't think anything about it. And I'm not very, I guess, computer literate or, you know, I guess, internet literate. And we've only been on Twitter, you know, for not too long. And that's about all we do is Twitter. So my phone just kept making these constant ding, ding, ding noises. So I checked and it was like just hundreds of notifications coming in.
So a lot of people reached out when they saw that message because it really impacted them. And why do you think David felt that way?
Well, he is hospital homebound. It's not his autism that keeps him home. He has something called rare severe immunodeficiency, which is basically he only has 20% of an immune system working. So he's hospital homebound. We have to limit his exposure, you know, to the outdoors. He goes for a lot of drives and we try to get him out. And if we go to a hotel, he mostly stays in the hotel room or looks on the balcony. And we have to do things where there's not many people around. He's never been, you know, in school. He hasn't been allowed to be around children his age. He's never had a friend because of that. So I know he's lonely, and I know, you know, we're doing the best we can to try, you know, to get him to have friends somehow. But I think, you know, he's smart enough to realize that, you know, he wants a friend and he wants people to like him.
Kerry Block talking about her son, David. South Africa has welcomed home its triumphant Springboks rugby team, returning from Japan after defeating England in the World Cup final. The victory is more than a sporting triumph for South Africa. For many, it's seen as a unifying moment for the nation, which rallied around the team, led by its first black captain, Siya Kolisi. The BBC asked some of the people waiting at the Tambo International Airport why this win was so important.
I think it changed South Africa. I think we don't see colour anymore. I mean, as we were standing here, there was whites, there was blacks, there was Indians, coloureds, it was everybody. The Rainbow Nation actually that Mandela was fighting for.
This is a team that's completely different. They're setting a new precedence in South Africa.
Our correspondent Milton Nkosi was at the airport.
It was absolutely electric. Throngs of people turned out here at the OR Tambo International Airport. I don't know if you can still hear them.
Oh, we can still hear it.
Are still celebrating officials who are leaving the airport now. They're exiting the actual terminal building and they are still screaming and shouting and waving and dancing, just celebrating this win because they know that this win is much more than sport. It is much more than the scoreline and crossing that white line. It's about unifying a nation that was divided for many years by the scourge of apartheid and racial segregation. So people came here to welcome the players, and they came with the Webb Ellis Cup. The first black captain of the Springbok, Siya Kolisi, lifted the cup up as he came through the arrivals hall, and there was absolute pandemonium. The police had a brass band. There was a brass band in the center of the floor, and there were people singing traditional South African songs. It was also emotional. It was very hard to contain one's emotions, even if you wanted to remain impartial, balanced and neutral.
Milton and Cozy, who is always impartial, balanced and neutral. Now, we've all been there. Sometimes online shopping can go horribly wrong. You might order a sweater in the wrong size or a piece of furniture that doesn't quite fit inside your home. Well, one man in New Zealand has seemingly outdone us all, accidentally buying enough livestock to start a small farm. Henry Bellow has the details.
Hamilton man Steve Morrow had a simple wish. He wanted to buy one singular, solitary chicken for his backyard. Instead, he got something that sounded more like this. Yes, Mr. Morrow accidentally purchased 1,000 birds rather than one. He blames the online auction advertisement written by an egg farmer who desperately needed to sell his flock before closing his farm. The post read, "One 1,000 birds." Mr. Morrow thought that meant the highest bidder could take as many birds as they wanted. So he made a small bid and won. But it took him some time to realise his error, especially given he paid less than $1 for the entire flock. Mr. Morrow is now trying to find new homes for the birds to avoid a slaughter. So far, 700 have been saved with the help of an animal sanctuary.
Henry Bellow reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard. From me and my chickens, goodbye.